introduction, I will go ahead and turn things over to your session facilitator, Cindy Frickle, from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. Cindy?
Thank you, Jean, and thank you all who joined us today. I just want to give you a quick overview of FRTR before we get started. So in case you're not familiar with the Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable, this is an interagency group that aims to build a collaborative atmosphere between federal agencies that are involved in hazardous waste site cleanup. So the presentations that you'll see today are redeliveries of presentations from a previous FRTR meeting. So we will have Jovan Popovic and Lisa Olson, who presented these talks at a meeting called PER and Polyfluoral Alkyl Substances, Emerging Characterization and Remedial Technologies. And as Jean mentioned, we've had one session already. That one is in the CLUIN archives, which I'll point you to later. And you can view that. And then we'll also have some info at the end of the presentations today about our upcoming FRTR meeting in November. So at this point, I'm going to just give you a quick intro to Lisa Olson. Lisa is joining us from U.S. Geological Survey. She's a water quality specialist, works for USGS's Water Mission Area in Reston, Virginia. And she has a BS in chemistry and MS in environmental science from the University of Memphis. From 93 to 2005, Lisa worked on studies of fate and transport and nutrients, pesticides, VOCs, and other contaminants in Tennessee and Maryland. Then in 2006, she took a technical advisory position in the California Water Science Center and later transitioned to the Southeast region of the U.S. Lisa's located at USGS headquarters in outside DC area. So Lisa would like to give credit to her co-authors on this project also. I'll let her do that herself today, but for now I will go ahead and hand it over to Lisa.
Thank you very much. All right, my name is Lisa Olson, and I would like to give credit to two other people who've helped me with the material that went into this presentation. James Gray is a chemist working for our National Water Quality Laboratory in Lakewood, Colorado, and Jerry Casiel is another employee of our Laboratory and Analytical Services Division who assists us with programs in Reston, Virginia. And I credit them with helping me with some of the specifics with our laboratory methods and our field sampling methods, respectively. So I'd like to start with five questions that or statements that I'm using for framing this presentation. Why is this so complicated? And the five statements include that we have PFAS compounds, poly and perfluoroalkyl substances. They're complex analytes with unusual properties, that the analytes themselves have properties that add to their complexity. The second, that they have interesting peculiarities in terms of their distribution in the environment. The third point, that our sampling supplies and equipment can be sources of these compounds or can have active substances that may absorb or remove or otherwise interact with these substances. And then once we are performing analyses in the laboratory, that we need to pay particular attention to laboratory best practices and quality assurance because of the tendency of these compounds to interact with surfaces or to be repulsed from surfaces. And then finally, there is a philosophical tension between the standardization of methods versus the types of changes in methods or adaptations or modifications of methods that could result in improvement. The basis for this presentation is a number of past PFAS studies that have been conducted by the U.S. Geological Survey, including some in conjunction with Department of Defense projects, U.S. EPA, and states, particularly in Delaware, New Jersey, Vermont, New York, et cetera. Several monitoring and occurrence studies, some studies that are fate and transport studies that are more looking at the systematic processes, maybe the unsystematic processes affecting PFAS, including a study in Cape Cod that I'll mention. Also considering the effects of mixtures, and there's not much degree of biodegradation, but what we do maybe see is precursors. I'm also going to discuss sampling protocols that have been developed by Jerry Casile, Stan Skroblowski, and others in the USGS, laboratory method development that is underway by James Gray in our National Water Quality Laboratory, and also the USGS has an informal internal PFAS collaboration group, work group that has, I think, about 70 people in it that periodically we have conference calls and we share just a status check on who's doing what where. That's been very useful for getting a sense of what the work and the challenges on the ground look like. So I'd like to start with a slide that there's many variations of a slide that looks like this in a lot of talks about PFAS, but they're complex analytes with unusual properties. I'm sorry, I'm about to... having trouble swallowing here. The PFAS compounds tend to be stable. They're resistant to breakdown. Their properties are largely attributed to the strength of the carbon-fluorine bond. The fluorine-fluoride, fluorine on the table of elements is the most electronegative atom that we've got on the periodic table of elements. So it tends to cling very tightly to the carbon that it's attached to, and so as a result, it tends to not want to cling to anything else, which gives it the non-stick qualities, gives the bond strength that makes these compounds very durable and hard to break down. Many of the PFAS molecules act as surfactants, so they have a water-soluble head end of the molecule, but the tail end is insoluble in water and oils, and so we have not just the concern that we've had in the past with other chlorinated solvents or other constituent groups with sorption. With the perfluorinated compounds, we also have the issue of repulsion, or the molecule just wants to play keep away, where it might want to straddle between a couple of different environmental matrices. So it might be found at the interfaces between water and soil or between water and air, because of the effects of this molecule, nature of it having the fluorine on the body and having a water-soluble head. The PFAS compounds, most of them don't fit a traditional octanol water coefficient, organic carbon partitioning coefficient, any of the partitioning coefficient isotherms. And so that affects what we would understand in terms of sorption or partitioning in the environment, that there's more of an entropy-driven sorption in spite of it having an anionic structure. So it's simultaneously highly water-soluble and simultaneously highly particle-reactive, so they tend to accumulate at the interfaces. I've put in a cartoon from Miao and others, 2017, that shows how PFAS molecules might interact with a soil particle in a system that includes an iron oxide and some silicates, and you can see if the perfluorinated compound, the molecule drawn as a squiggle with the line through it, that some of them are oriented head in, touching the particles, and some are oriented facing outward, and there's a couple that are sideways. So this is a little different variety of behaviors that you can have at the molecular scale or at the particle scale. So the PFAS compounds, being complex analytes with unusual properties, with the other facets of this to consider is that we have different chain lengths, that we have long chain perfluorinated compounds with six or more carbons, some that are or perfluorocarboxylic acids, the PFCAs, with greater than or equal to eight carbons, including the PFOA compound, the perfluoroalkyl sulfonates, the PFSAs, with greater than six compounds, including the perfluorohexane sulfonic acid and the perfluorooctane sulfonic acid. So the ones that we very commonly hear about in the news. There are also some short chain molecules that are precursors, including fluorotelomers, the alcohols, and there are branched and straight chained isomers of many of these compounds, and then adding to the complexity, there are precursors, there are degradates, and so there are a number of variations. I've heard, 3,000 to 4,000 compounds, maybe, possibly being variations of the PFAS. In most of our laboratory analyses, we're looking at maybe 24 to 35 compounds. So it's a bit of a challenge. The number of PFAS compounds that might be cause for concern is thought to be in the hundreds and continues to grow. This is a quote from the ASDWA organization linked at the bottom. And since the phase out of the PFOA, PFAS, the two compounds that have EPA health advisory levels that have been phased out, companies have shifted to shorter chain PFAS alternatives, or PFAS, they're not really alternatives that aren't PFAS, they are PFAS compounds that are alternatives to the longer chain, such as Gen X, which is now a significant concern in the Cape Fear watershed in North Carolina in particular. So there's a cartoon in the lower left that shows a sampling location upstream and downstream, where the upstream location labeled A might have an assortment of legacy PFAS compounds, the traditional ones, but then maybe farther downstream where you have things diminishing, but you have a fluorochemical manufacturer that we would have maybe a predominant concentration being of the Gen X compound. So the mixtures make things very complex. Moving on to my second point is that the PFAS compounds have interesting peculiarities in terms of their distribution in the environment. And this has a lot to do with the types of sources for these compounds. And this slide shows a number of photographs of household products and industrial uses where we can have the perfluorinated compounds. So they've been used in like Stainmaster carpet and other, I shouldn't maybe mention brands, but other treated carpets that are that have stain resistant qualities to them. There are carpet cleaning products. There's a prominent product on the market that on the label says with Teflon on it. There's food packaging, so there's the popcorn that you see there where there's maybe a nonstick or a plastic coating in the food packaging. Furnishings that have nonstick coatings. There are cosmetics, outdoor gear, clothing that would maybe have some waterproofing. There's some adhesive sealants, protective coatings that you can spray on your leather. Leather shoes, there's nonstick cookware, there's all kinds of upholstered items, car seats in the example. And then a really big category is firefighting foam, so the aqueous film forming foams that have been used for fire suppression in a lot of civilian locations and in military applications. So this is just bullet points mentioning some of the studies where PFAS compounds have entered into the environment through industrial and municipal wastewater treatment plants, firefighting incidents and training areas, and landfills. And the complexity comes in when you think about what releases might be point releases from application of a firefighting foam versus an aerial release where maybe it's applied at a larger area versus non-point, or where you maybe had a point release and soil was removed and spread out in a larger area subsequent to the original contamination. So there are many different ways of these substances entering the environment where you can have some ambient concentrations in some places that may have traced back to an aerial release or a point source. It's just really hard to tell. The concentration thresholds relative to human health benchmarks relevant in terms of effects to human health, they're very small. The U.S. EPA lifetime advisory level for PFAS and PFOA, the eight carbon chain length compounds that are most commonly regulated, is 0.070 micrograms per liter, and that's equivalent to 70 nanograms per liter. So we're getting into tiny units. And also we can have a huge range of concentrations when these enter the environment. So there can be very small-scale events or small concentration events or some spills can have concentrations that are greater than 2,000 micrograms per liter, so that would be greater than 2 million nanograms per liter. The map that I'm showing here, it comes from the Environmental Working Group, and I understand that that's an advocacy organization, but the data that are being depicted here come from the UCMR, EPA UCMR studies, military studies. There's a, through CERCLA, RCRA, and the data points on here are fairly well referenced to hard science. So even though this is a map from an advocacy group, I still find this useful for getting a sense of distribution and sites on the ground. And this this map is helpful that you can click on a particular dot or hover over it, and it'll give you information. So the point that this little blow up is pointing to being an example, Klamath Falls, their airport, what the range of concentrations might be, other PFAS compounds that are present other than the PFOA and the PFOS, suspected source firefighting foam, and then there's a link to the documentation that backs up where the source data came from. So I find that a useful just to figure out where we're seeing compounds. The other interesting point with the perfluorinated compounds is that they have an interesting distribution in the environment. So contaminants from point sources usually don't follow a normal distribution. So like you would think of something like pH, where most of the water is close to 7 and you might have most of it between 6 and 8, but you might have some rare instances where you get really low or really high. That would be a normal distribution, which would be what that gray bell-shaped curve is indicating. And for point source contaminants, what we more often see is a log normal distribution, where you have many, many instances of very low concentrations with a long tail and very rare instances of very high concentrations. So just knowing the shape of the distribution is important. The contaminants that emanate from a point source, you could imagine if you just have a spherical point source of spill where something starts off with a very high concentration, 100% of whatever is spilled, and that it emanates from a point source. And this is an absence of any groundwater flow or any other process, and you could imagine this in three dimensions. But as the contaminants emanate from the center, you get smaller and smaller concentrations. And it's a fair question to say, how far out can you go and you still see any pink? The detection limit that you use to see the compound plays an important role in understanding, well, how far out does the spill go? It greatly depends on your ability to detect it. So this kind of distribution, you can imagine, going back, if I were to imagine I'm sampling, there's going to be a huge number of points on this slide where the concentrations are really low, really close to the detection limit. Few more concentrations on this graph might be in this medium pink zone, and you could do a lot of sampling and maybe miss the pinpoint center of a diagram like this. So when we see sampling data, this is from a different contaminant where we have a lot more data accumulated for perchlorate, you get this where you've got a very huge number of non-detections and a smaller number of detections. And what the red thing that I'm having trouble reading is, I think it's 583 detections that are greater than a detection limit of 4 micrograms per liter. But you see this tailing. This is that distribution where you have one concentration out here at about 400 or 420. And so that's usual. So don't be surprised if in sampling you find like very few detections, but then you maybe every once in a while find one that's maybe higher. And this makes sampling very difficult. So if you could imagine you have the most amazing budget in the world and you put out sampling points everywhere that you can in a gridded system, you can see the likelihood of maybe not hitting the highest most concentration is really, it's pretty pretty high that you could miss the exact center of a plume this way. So you have to combine their understanding of this behavior along with hydrology and some characterization of where you think the suspected spill site is, the direction of flow. And a good example of this is this article from Cape Cod that I was referring to at the beginning of my presentation. This is lead authored by Andrea Weber, who's going by Andrea Tokrenov now, this geochemical and hydrologic factors controlling subsurface transport of the perfluorinated compounds in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. The green plume area is based on boron concentrations, and then we have some characterization of PFAS concentrations that are shown in color coding, with the darker purple being higher concentrations. So this is just a plan view, a map view of a contaminant plume with further characterization. This article shows some beautiful plots of dissolved oxygen and the sum of all the PFAS compounds, the PFOS, and then the PFOS as a percentage of the total. And there are a number of other beautiful plots, but you can see that this is not a straightforward circular diagram, that understanding the hydrology, understanding the features that are above the land surface, whether there are any like local lakes or any sources of preferential flow, that this characterization part becomes really, really very challenging. So again, this is contributing to why is this so complicated. Moving on to when we go to sample, another complexity is that our sampling supplies and equipment can be sources of the perfluorinated compounds, or they can have active surfaces, and we need to be mindful of repulsions and attractions, not just sorption. The materials that can sorb the PFAS compounds include glass, low-density polyethylene, plastic, polypropylene, depending on the chain length of the PFAS molecules that we're studying. And most commonly used filters use these materials. So when we want to do analysis, a lot of the instrumentation that we would put a water sample through, having particles can cause clogging, can cause a lot of difficulty with the analysis. So it's important in many methods to remove the particles. A lot of them are analyzing filtered samples. But we were concerned about the interactions of filters with the analytes of interest. So we are, in USGS method testing, looking at using centrifugation rather than filtration to remove particles. There are also some materials that can leach PFAS compounds, including any of the fluoropolymers like Teflon. So Teflon is commonly used for sampling other organic compounds, but we would want to avoid it for sampling any of the perfluorinated compounds, anything with fluoro in the name. And also any material that absorbed PFAS and is reused. So you don't want to risk cross-contaminating from one site to the other. It's also important to use blank water and reagents that we know are free from PFAS and also that are freshly opened. So if you have an opened container of something and you have a headspace that has been in an environment where there are Teflon or PFAS-containing substances around, you can have partitioning into blank water. So you want to have freshly opened containers of blank water. We are using the Fisher Optima LCMS grade blank water. But we are aware of a number of people who have in-house deionized water systems that are using their blank water with no problem. If in doubt, you can test it. And we would recommend people testing blanks very frequently for these compounds. There are a number of sampling protocols already in the literature. There's sampling protocols that are associated with US EPA Method 537. There's a US EPA technical brief. There's a Department of Defense, the www.denix.osd.mil, PFAS home. You can probably Google search PFAS DOD and find that resource pretty quickly. There are a number of states that have good sampling protocols for PFAS. For example, Massachusetts Department of Environment, DEP, their program has good PFAS protocol. Also, the National Groundwater Association, ITRC, Tetra Tech, those are all organizations that have put together good protocols. The protocols are very intimidating. Some of them have very long lists of materials and supplies to be avoided. Some of them recommend like covering the seats of your car so that you aren't getting cross-transfer of waterproofing materials from your upholstered car seats in your vehicle. There's quite a lot there. We recommend doing the things that seem prudent without necessarily going overboard. But what is very important is that you pay close attention to the items that actually come close to or in contact with the sample water. So you can think within a sampling environment, you might have waterproof boots, you might have treated fabrics, you might have your personal care products. I don't know how many people might, you know, are you very careful about not having used fabric softener on your clothing? I think that some of these things get difficult. So you don't want to have anything that is creating odors, anything that is coming off of your hands, but what's in contact with the sample. So if you're very careful with your sampling environment, you have gloved hands. We recommend the gloves that have the 8-inch cuff. And you're keeping your face out of the sample, you're keeping your clothing out of the sample, that we can use some of that just being attentive to what's coming in contact with the sample water and minimizing contact with the sample water is probably the best advice that we can provide. There are materials that can be used when we're sampling: stainless steel, brass, copper, high-density plastic and silicon, nitrile or polyethylene for gloves. With the nitrile and polyethylene gloves, you know, those are great, but, you know, you don't want to have a box of nitrile gloves that's been open for 6 months and then, you know, assume that they're still perfectly clean. So freshly purchased, freshly opened. A Bennett pump as produced, we've tested and is working fine for producing data without contamination from the pump itself. And any materials that are tested prior to use. So if in doubt, you can set up blank water and do some testing and verify that the materials work. So there's some pictures on this slide of things that we've tested. So stainless steel fittings, we have a tough light adapter. So when we're trying to thread together different plumbing to get to the sample, we're using high density polyethylene sample bottles and centrifuge tubes to collect our samples. And we used either copper tubing or high-density polyethylene tubing. With good cleaning protocols, the copper tubing is reusable. We're not reusing the high-density polyethylene tubing just because of concern of potential cross-contamination. So laboratory best practices and quality assurance are needed, and this is where we need the cooperation of the field staff. We need field QC in addition to laboratory QC. So we would have equipment blanks for supplies and materials or combinations thereof, field blanks to assess the effectiveness of SOPs at preventing contamination, especially at low levels. And then if we have a circumstance where contamination is identified that we don't think is part of the environmental sample, that we're concerned might be part of our sampling equipment or extrinsic accidental contamination, if we get background contamination and we can't quite pinpoint where is it coming from, it's very important to have enough field blanks to be able to characterize the frequency and magnitude of the contamination. So best to avoid it to begin with, but if you find that you have low-level contamination, it's a matter of collecting a sufficient number of field blanks to be able to very statistically robustly characterize that all the contamination is below a certain number. And then replicates and spare samples are important with, when working with difficult matrices such as wastewater, effluent, sediment, or tissue, because it's possible when you're working with a complex matrix that it's just an extra challenge for the laboratory. And if a laboratory has difficulty working with a sample, it's very useful to be able to do a reanalysis. So if you have a spare sample, you collect an extra bottle, that gives you some versatility if something happens in the laboratory where you're not sure, did I get the right number? Did we get, you know, the extraction or the analysis performed right? You have a spare for checking. And I think these are good and prudent steps to take whenever we start a laboratory for method or field method for constituents that are new to us. Going to shift now my focus to the laboratory method that is in validation at the USGS National Water Quality Laboratory. It's being tested for approximately 35 compounds, and we have a anticipation that the validation is going to be successful for more than 24 compounds. There are some compounds where it's difficult to get pure analytical standards, certified reference materials, so that is a limitation. There are a number of compounds that maybe you can detect and semi-quantify, but if you want to have a good, robust method, we need to trace back to traceable analytical standards. So that is a limitation for having methods. Now, if you want to look purely in a research sense, there's quite a bit more, larger number of compounds that can be detected through various instrumentation. The method that's in validation now is an LC-MS-MS method with negative electrospray ionization conditions using an Agilent 6495 triple quadrupole with direct aqueous injection, except for some compounds where we need to use SPE, solid phase extraction. So we have the sensitivity for a number of compounds to get good detection limits directly introducing the sample. But there are some compounds where we need to use the SPE for providing a pre-concentrated sample from a larger volume. All of the consumables in the instrumentation are polypropylene or similar plastic with no PFTE or glass fittings. So all the PFTE tubing has been removed from the flow path and been replaced with PEEK or stainless steel. And also, as I've mentioned earlier, we've eliminated the filtration step, and we're using centrifugation for particle removal. And we're testing that and seeing how well that works, so that we're reducing the amount of surfaces that the sample comes in contact with. The new NWQL method will be extensively tested prior to making it available for USGS studies and other. Cooperators, partners, other entities can partner with us in using the method. We typically work with folks in USGS water science centers so that samples are submitted within a hydrologic context, and we get good characterization of the metadata, when, where, who collected the sample, when those things are when the samples are sent to the NWQL for analysis. And we also have the methodology that was independently developed by the folks in the Weber and others ES&T article from 2017, the method used for the Cape Cod study. So I'm going to my final statement of why is this so complex or complicated. There is a tension between standardization versus changes that could result in improvement, and I think that this is the case whenever we're working with a situation where we have a research need and a regulatory need. So there are methods that may be very highly characterized, highly documented, that are important for regulatory compliance because we want to ensure that the methods are buttoned down tight, that the performance data are very firmly understood. So this first bullet represents that the monitoring for regulatory compliance that we recommend using labs and methods that are approved by a regulatory entity. For example, the US EPA method 537 from a laboratory that was accredited for the USCMR work, or there is the Department of Defense PFAS laboratory accreditation program. And those would be appropriate for when you're working in a regulatory context. If you're working on a DOD site, you need to be compliant with DOD practices. If you're working with EPA, Superfund, CERCLA, RCRA, whatever, you would want to use whatever you need to do to be compliant with that program. Same thing with Department of Energy or any other regulatory entity. There are a number of modifications of EPA 537 for additional matrices, for additional compounds, et cetera. And I've put a quote from the US EPA that they're not aware of standardized descriptions for the modified methods, nor is the agency aware of studies that have validated the performance of these modified methods across multiple laboratories. Therefore, the EPA cannot address the performance of modified method 537 in a general manner. So if you're considering using a modified method 537 to analyze a sample, the EPA recommends that you evaluate its appropriateness relative to your goals for your data and your data quality objectives. So more simply put, this modified 537 could be modified maybe a couple of dozen different ways. And I've seen with some of the laboratories that the USGS has contracted while we're waiting for firm approval of our own method, that we've seen differences in different modifications of 537. And so getting what those modifications are, getting those documented, having QC data, documenting the method performance, that's very important. So that said, there's also room for having modifications, having additional compounds, having modifications that result in method improvement, especially when you're looking in a research or a reconnaissance phase. If we're trying to find more than the 24 compounds that are in the 537 method, that there's room for that. So some of the trade-off is whether you're doing targeted analyses where everything is ground truth to certified reference materials versus a broad spectrum analysis, such as using high-resolution mass spec, or in other words, the trade-off between doing robust quantitation of single individual compounds versus getting the whole picture. There are also analyses that can be performed for total organic fluorine and for total oxidizable precursors, so those can add to the picture. And so you've got this this tension between, do you stick with the pure approved EPA 537 method, or do you look at research methods? And it may be beneficial to combine multiple complementary methods. And so you want to adapt or pick your methods to suit the circumstances in which you're applying them, and ensure that your laboratory provides sufficient QC. For example, using isotopically labeled standards, using surrogates, so that you get the performance data for the laboratory method that you've picked, and using field QC to supplement your laboratory QC. So just advice to be attentive when you're looking for a laboratory for your analyses, to know what it is that you're getting and make sure that it's appropriate for the context for the type of study that you need to use it in. So that's the end of my presentation, and I will turn this over to the moderators to help me field any questions you might have.
Thank you, Lisa. I have a couple of questions for you before we move on. So first off, someone asked if there is a publicly available list that you know of, or a database that has products containing PFAS.
I am not aware of a compiled list of all the possible products that are containing PFAS. They're very widely used, and some uses are in very minor quantities. Like in particular in cosmetics, I would have no idea which ones unless by reading label after label after label. In addition, there are also consumer products that are sold to spray on things, to apply to things that, it's very hard for me to keep track, even in my own household, of what things might have PFAS compounds applied or sprayed or used. I'm not aware of a database that list that with the slides, those are big category bins, but like I couldn't begin to say whether a particular upholstered fabric product would have PFAS compounds or not. Sometimes it's labeled as part of the branding that something has a waterproof or stain release or whatever technology, but not reliably labeled.
Okay, thank you. Now, another participant asks if you could talk a little bit more about how does a large amount of field blanks reveal contamination from your equipment versus the environment?
Okay, so in an ideal world, you'll collect a lot of field blanks and they will all have non-detections and we won't have an issue. But in circumstances where maybe we have an issue with blank water and we need to do some troubleshooting, you can use field blanks or a combination of process blanks to try to troubleshoot and find the source of the contamination. And in some instances, we haven't seen this so far with PFAS, so we're being just very cautious by doing a large number of field blanks. But in some instances, we've seen some constituents where you get absorption of the compound from the air or from something in the sampling environment. Or when we've used filters, maybe filters is a very good example where we've seen like very low-level cobalt or very low-level manganese in all of our filtered samples because it's intrinsic to the filter material itself, that by using a very large number of field blanks, then we would have a population of data that would show that maybe our background contamination is reliably below 0.5 micrograms per liter or below 0.1 micrograms per liter. And if you have a good population of data to show that the background contamination is reliably low, then maybe you wind up with a data set where you can interpret safely the concentrations that are greater than that background concentration. So as we push our laboratory methods to get more and more sensitive and we are analyzing compounds that are used so ubiquitously, that we had concerns given all of the possible sources that might be present in our sampling environment, that out of a concern that we may detect these compounds in our blanks, we front-loaded our QC program to include a very, very, very large number of blanks. And fortunately, with the protocols that we're using, we are not seeing detections in our blanks, which is great. But I have heard from other studies where they have had detections. Has that answered it?
Okay, thank you, Lisa. We have a number of more questions coming in, but I think in the interest of time, we're going to move on to our next speaker. So thank you again, Lisa Olson. If we have some time at the end, we may come back to you for some questions. So thanks, Lisa. So our next speaker today is Jovan Popovic. He's an environmental engineer at the Naval Facilities Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center. There he works to develop physicochemical treatment options for PFAS-impacted groundwater and soil. Another major focus area of Dr. Popovich's research is applied anaerobic microbiology, especially in transformation of anthropogenic organic contaminants. He's throwing me some tongue twisters here. Bioelectrochemistry, heavy metal and nutrient removal from agricultural and mining waste streams, and commodity chemical production. So prior to joining NAVFAC, Dr. Popovich was a postdoc at the University of Minnesota's Biotechnology Institute. Go Gophers. Dr. Popovich received his PhD in environmental engineering at Clemson University. So now I'll hand it over to Jovan.
All right. Thank you so much. Good afternoon or good morning if you are listening on the West Coast. My name is Jovan Popovich. Today I'll be giving a brief talk on PFAS site characterization. I firstly wanted to thank the EPA, or extend my warmest gratitude to them for letting me deliver this webinar from their office in Potomac Yards while I'm on the road. So thank you very much for that. In any event, since we have a lot of interesting data to cover in such a short time frame, I'm going to go ahead and dive right into this talk. So during today's webinar, let me advance that slide real quick, I'm going to give a very brief primer on some of the introductory topics, including potential PFAS sources that we may see at federal, municipal, and commercial level, Following this, I'm going to move on to a somewhat cursory introduction to the more relevant physical chemical properties of PFAS that make PFAS plumes behave in the manner in which they do. Following this, I'll briefly touch on some current analytical methods used in PFAS analysis, as well as methods that are currently in development. Keep in mind that a lot of this section is more DOD-specific, as it highlights methods that may have been compatible with our own QSM or Quality Systems Manual. Then finally, before wrapping up, we'll get to take a look at some interesting data from an ongoing case study being performed at one of our sites. These data, keep in mind, are a little bit research heavy, but you know, some of the key findings that were elucidated here may have a broader application to your site in particular, should you ultimately try to proceed with characterizing your site at this level of detail. Okay, moving on. So with the understanding that the audience is likely aware of all the different flavors of PFAS sources, and you know, Lisa did a really good job of covering this material, we only included one slide here for potential sources that may pertain to federal, municipal, or the industrial level. Typical source areas include, but are not limited to, AFFF impacted sites, and these typically harbor your highest concentration PFAS plumes. And these are mostly populated with the ECF-based or electrochemically fluorinated-based sulfonates and carboxylates, or what we commonly refer to as the old PFAS-containing AFFF formulation, aka pre-telomerization. Chrome plating shops have come onto our radar recently, as there have may have been some level of release from mist suppression systems. But considering the decades of disposal of PFAS-laden food packaging, even though they might be compostable, and other commercially available materials, landfill leachate really takes a close second with respect to reported concentrations. And regarding the chemical makeup, we tend to find mostly short-chain carboxylates and fluorotelomer acids in this matrix. But moving on to our last culprit on the list, wastewater treatment effluent. Some sources posit that this is typically the third highest PFAS source, and while we may see some level of PFOS removal during separation of solids, PFOA and fluorotelomer sulfonates do not undergo much removal of these PFAS types. One other thing to note is that taking into consideration of PFOS's affinity for organics or, you know, the solid fraction of wastewater, we do run into the issue of creating additional secondary sources, especially in scenarios which there's been historical use of biosolid application. But with that, this concludes our brief walkthrough of potential PFAS sources that you may encounter along the way when performing a site characterization. But let's now move on to characteristics of PFAS plumes. There we go. So let me make sure here. So I guess on this next slide, we'll begin to cover some generalization of the physicochemical properties of PFAS and what causes them to migrate or remain sequestered at sites that had historical release. So in these upcoming slides, I'm going to begin by introducing AFFF, more specifically PFAS-containing AFFF. So PFAS-containing AFFF was originally produced by electrochemical fluorination. Think along the lines of something resembling a Frankenstein chemistry. And we saw this in use up until about the early 2000s when existing stockpiles of this phase-out material was used. I guess some of the most interesting characteristics to note about this formulation, or about the ECF-derived AFFF, is that most of these formulations typically had an even split of about 30 to 70% branched versus linear isomers of PFAS, and about 89% of this formulation was comprised of sulfonates, so think like PFOS or PFHXS. Only about 1 or 2% of this formulation contained PFOA, which is, you know, pretty nice, but these considerations, especially that of the branched versus linear ratio, can give you some important information with respect to whenever you're doing site forensics. Such as if you're trying to find out which sources were used historically, and also, as we'll see in our case study, how these different chemical properties can affect transport. So that's how we would typically describe the old PFAS-containing AFFF in a nutshell. But what about current formulations? So currently in use, we have the telomere-based AFFF. This is produced through the telomerization process, hence this is why we call it telomere-based. So to really anthropomorphize PFAS a bit here, this process doesn't attempt to reanimate a soup of chemicals using electrical current like the ECF process does. And this leaves end products that are primarily, if not completely, linear isomers. So no branching like we would see in ECF-derived PFAS production. So one nice aspect of this particular chemistry is that little to no PFAS is produced. However, there are a couple of drawbacks to this process, more specifically with respect to shorter chain compounds being produced, like C6 and below, for instance. And this creates a scenario for increased mobility in comparison to our longer chain counterparts. Furthermore, there is a possibility of for transformation of the telomere-based products into carboxylates. So I guess now that we have somewhat of a cursory understanding of the two different production processes and the products that are produced, talk about alliteration here, let's dive a little deeper and take a look at how certain broad characteristics of PFAS affect partitioning and transport. So generally, most PFAS in which we're interested resemble a polar aliphatic molecule in which the fluorocarbon tail imparts hydrophobic characteristics. And the polar head group, you know, ultimately imparts solubility in water, while, you know, the fluorocarbon tail imparts, you know, the hydrophobic characteristics. So from what is observed across the board in the literature and in case studies, we typically see faster migration of PFAS that contain carboxylate groups in comparison to that of similar chain lengths, which contain sulfonate groups. So on this next slide here, I guess diving in a little deeper into the molecular charge, we generally observe that the transport of anionic PFAS occurs more readily readily than that of both zwitterionic and cationic PFAS. I hope I didn't just cause some sort of flashback to your general chemistry class, but but when I talk about zwitter ions, I'm talking about amphoteric molecules that impart both a positive and a negative charge, whereas anions and cations, they impart either a net negative or a net positive charge, respectively. And, you know, it wasn't until very recently that we really observed this phenomenon with respect to PFAS charge affecting transport, but I guess it does exist. But, you know, switching gears a bit here, I believe I mentioned earlier when talking about the different production processes, we do see diminished transport with PFAS that are of greater chain length. But a point that I'll kind of highlight in this next slide, slide 9 here, is that, ultimately branched PFAS that have, you know, more hydrophobicity attributed to the overall molecular structure is you know, these molecules do tend to migrate a little bit more readily than its linear counterparts. I guess, you know, then to summarize again, that due to the, you know, general surfactant nature of these compounds, PFAS, you know, does have a low vapor pressure and low Henry's constant, well, for PFOS and PFOA, which is listed on here specifically, in comparison to more volatile compounds such as TCE or benzene. So moving on to the next slide here, which covers certain soil chemistry characteristics that affect PFAS transitioning and transport. What we commonly find and what is generally reported in the literature is that firstly, organic-rich soils have a tendency to foster greater PFAS affinity. Somewhat along the same vein here, we generally see more PFAS sorption in the presence of NAPL. Think from the perspective of co-localized PFAS with, you know, let's say unignited fuel in, you know, fire training areas. We find that also that soils and sediments offer some level of cation exchange capacity, to better bind or sequester PFAS in your source areas. Okay, moving on to this next slide here. With respect to some groundwater chemistry characteristics that ultimately affect PFAS partitioning and transport, there are two factors apparent in groundwater that can play a role in PFAS plume stability. The first one ultimately being ionic strength, So if you were to take, for example, sites which are localized kind of near coastal areas and have, you know, somewhat high saltwater intrusion into the subsurface, or, you know, have like highly saline groundwater, you really don't see too much migration of PFAS, which is kind of fortuitous. but also in scenarios in which you encounter low pH, I guess in which we would observe changes in protonation absorption sites, think electrostatic anion exchange in clays and mineral oxides in the subsurface, we do also see some PFAS retardation. And I guess somewhat unrelated to the main theme that is being addressed on this slide is the relationship of co-localized contaminants, which can ultimately outcompete, you know, PFAS for these sorption sites, thus affecting its transport. So on this next slide here, we have a chart that describes soil adsorption coefficients and retardation factors, starting with our long-chain PFAS compounds, both carboxylates and sulfonates, and on the left-hand side. And as you migrate towards the right-hand slide of this chart, we will see more shorter-chain sulfonates and carboxylates. So the data presented here kind of essentially reinforce what was covered on the previous summary slides, which describe factors affecting PFAS sorption. I guess for the sake of you know, time, and because we have a lot of other cool material to cover here, I will just briefly describe these data. So for our longer chain PFAS on the left-hand side here, this is inclusive of both the carboxylates and sulfonates, so things like C8 and above. We observe a substantially higher adsorption and retardation in soil than their shorter chain counterparts. I'll have to double check, but I believe these data were derived from one of Jen Guelfo's and Chris Higgins' ESET papers. I think it might have been like 2013 or 2014. But again, you know, the ultimate intention of these data is to really reinforce what we saw on the previously mentioned slides for factors affecting PFAS sorption. So moving on to the next slide here, which describes what is typically understood about PFAS's behavior in the source zone, is that PFAS really like to stick around at the air-water interface, owing primarily to, if you recall from the previous slides, its surfactant nature, in which a polar head group imparts solubility to water, and its aliphatic tail, being hydrophobic, has a tendency to avoid water, hence the hydrophobic designation of the compound. In some cases, we'll see in our case study, although we may think that PFAS will always exist at the air-water interface, there's evidence for vertical migration beyond this interface. But this is likely due to other factors, including but not limited to high regional recharge. And as mentioned earlier, PFAS does have a tendency to partition into NAPL, but we won't be covering that. We won't have any data covering that in our current talk today. So moving on to the next slide, this information kind of just pertains to the effects of prior remediation and PFAS transport. So, you know, keep in mind, PFAS didn't really come onto everyone's radar up until relatively recently. But if you were to take into consideration, for example, you know, some of the activities involved in, you know, firefighter training in which, you know, some combustible fuel may have been released to the subsurface prior to the practice of using lined fire training pits, some of these remedies to remove the NAPL from the site may have actually increased PFAS mobility. However, again, nobody really knew about PFAS until recently, so we didn't really know that, you know, some of these oxidative processes were ultimately releasing additional PFAS that were sequestered in the NAPL. So, yeah, again, like if you use remedies such as oxidation, you know, ripping apart, you know, organics, this would free up PFAS. Conversely, you know, if you were to use a remedy such as persulfate, this may have had a positive impact, as this would foster conditions such as lower pH to increase, I guess, mineral availability and increase PFAS sorption, and as I described previously in this section. So also, you know, adding organic amendments such as emulsified oil may have actually increased PFAS retention at the source. So these are just a few kind of points just to take in consideration when you're trying to understand how previous remedies may have either liberated or helped sequester PFAS at your site. So I guess to cap off this section, the sheer knowledge of PFAS is constantly evolving. You know, laboratories are getting much better at understanding the behavior of this contaminant class and how to study it in a controlled and sometimes uncontrolled environment. And these data ultimately trickle down to us and the practitioners. You know, so it's really our job to make sure that we're staying educated, whether it be in the form of understanding our own sites and interpreting our own observations in the field, or really paying a close attention to the literature, especially to those groups who are pioneering a lot of these research to kind of broaden our understanding of the problem. But with that, let's move on to some analytical methods used for PFAS detection and quantitation. So I guess this upcoming session will, section will primarily describe various methods for PFAS analysis specific to the DoD. So any non-DoD folks can stop listening. I'm kidding. So we included this section in here to essentially summarize. To essentially summarize appropriate analytical methods for specific scenarios with a subtle DoD twist, of course. You know, in any event, let's discuss EPA method 537.1 in the context of its utility. So two important considerations to note here are that this method is for drinking water only, and there's no such thing as a modified EPA 537, or I guess within the DoD community, and we don't really, we think this is like an all or nothing drinking water method, and so we kind of dismiss it when someone mentions that their method is modified 537. However, we do recognize in-house methods that are compliant with Table B15 of our QSM 5.1 or greater. But with that, I'm going to transition into the next slide, describing some of these in-house methods. So these in-house methods for laboratories that are DoD ELAP accredited for analyzing PFAS, according to Table B15 of QSM 5.1 or greater, usually run at an expanded list of 24 compounds, inclusive of a few fluorotelomer sulfonates and a few FOSA analytes. Excuse me. For the last bullet, I believe the latest QSM or Quality Systems Manual that was released is version 5.3. So this bullet point actually might be a little dated. But moving on to the next slide here, what about all the other PFASs? You know, some researchers posit that the number of detectable PFAS compounds is in the range of thousands. But if any of you are on here right now, feel free to correct me and if I'm really grossly misled with this value. In any event, there are more than 24 PFAS compounds we're finding at a lot of sites. And this has very recently come onto everyone's radar as analytical method development becomes increasingly robust. However, until analytical standards are developed for these hundreds or even thousands of compounds, I think these methods are understood to be qualitative for the time being. So what really is the impetus for analyzing PFAS beyond the typical 14 to 24 compounds that are listed under the, EPA method 537 and other in-house methods? So there are several reasons other than trying to satiate academic curiosity, and these mostly pertain to understanding how PFAS that aren't detected with the previously listed methods behave in the environment, as well as engineered treatment systems. I guess, for instance, you know, short-chain PFAS are typically your sentinel compounds that can inform practitioners as to PFAS plume migration or breakthrough in your pump and treat system. Because, like I mentioned in previous slides, you know, short-chain PFAS don't really sorb too well to anything, save for the exceptions for like a few ion exchange resins, maybe cationic polymers. But in any event, it's important really that the analytical methods you use can detect and quantify these compounds. You know, a few other reasons that one may want to include more of a robust analytical method in their study is to really elucidate transformation products. And attempt to close in PFAS mass balance. I guess it's kind of like the holy grail is attempting to close that balance here. This also, you can try to trace mixed source plumes. And I guess pretty relevant to today's talk, especially with respect to our case study, is detecting cations and zwitterion PFAS species. But moving on to the next slide here. So I guess to wrap up the section pertaining to analytical methods, I'm going to quickly go over and go over some of the emerging methods that may be useful to you depending on the matrix that you ultimately tend to analyze. So in the future, you know, be on the lookout for these. First, we have EPA method OW, which is a new drinking water method that improves upon a current drinking water method. This method will include about, 25 compounds with a focus on short-chain PFAS, which is very important. Next, we have EPA SW846 for non-potable water matrices. But for my DOD folks on the line, I'm sorry, this method would not be compatible with our own QSM. However, you know, EPA SW846 method 8328 will be compatible, and this will work for both non-potable water as well as sediment. With that, I'm going to end this section and kind of transition right into our case study, I guess, to make sure we're staying on time here. Are we okay. Good on time?
We're good.
All right. So the case study that I will be describing today is currently taking place at Naval Air Station Jacksonville as part of my colleague John Cornick's ESCCP work involving high-resolution PFAS characterization, site characterization. His project is in collaboration with GSI Environmental, Colorado School of Mines, Oregon State University, as well as University of Notre Dame. I think we listed all of them here now. This is one site at which we are doing some follow-on work with in a NAFAC headquarters-funded project to really to elucidate the effects of natural retardation and matrix diffusion on contaminant mass transport at this site, as well as developing some predictive models to track the plume over time. So this follow-on work is ultimately in collaboration with our academic partners at UCLA, Colorado State University, and GSI Environmental. Ultimately, we're taking a very holistic approach at understanding this constantly evolving problem, and I will be touching on some of the preliminary data generated thus far. So again, to reiterate, our approach here was to utilize high-resolution techniques to better elucidate PFAS source areas and differentiate the types of sources. Furthermore, we wanted to determine site-specific factors affecting PFAS transport, including but not limited to organic carbon, pH, ionic strength, and redox conditions. So moving on to the next slide, I guess just to continue with our description of the study, we characterized the PFAS composition in various media, such as solid and aqueous matrices, to better understand variations with respect to PFAS transport across disparate PFAS chemistries. Furthermore, in this particular study, we sought to elucidate the effects of low-K or low permeability zones on mass storage and flux, as well as identify some precursors and transformation products. To gather all these data, we had to rely on a very large battery of analyses that have been performed and are still continuing to date. Okay, so but let's move on to the site in question on the next slide here. We'll be focusing on the fire training area at NAS Jacksonville, for which there are two pits, one which was unlined and used from the late 60s up until the early 90s, and the other pit, which is kind of just north of the former pit, is the kind of the newer or lined pits. We're going to focus our attention on two circles here. Let me use my pointer because this is a very small circle that you're probably looking at on the screen. So this is our former pit here, and this is our newer pit just a little north. And we're going to focus our attention here on this green box here. This is our experimentation site. And what we found, I guess this groundwater arrow is moving is a little misleading because the groundwater will change direction about 30 feet or so below ground surface, kind of migrating more towards the runway here. (Clears throat) So, but yeah, but I did not include these slides in this talk today just for the sake of time. But, yeah, we do have kind of a two-direction groundwater flow depending on the depth at which you are sampling. So there are a total of three mobilizations to the site. September 2017 was the first mobilization. I wasn't working for NAFAC at that time. But data from this mobilization showed some indication of vertical PFAS migration patterns. And this is kind of very strange data to see. You know, you typically think that PFAS is typically localized within the bathos zone. But so we were asked to kind of confirm that these data were not, in fact, sampling artifacts. And, you know, this ultimately led to second mobilization in which multiple cluster wells were installed and screened at intervals from about 5 to 50 feet. I was there for that mobilization. Jacksonville is very hot and rainy in July. so these were installed and sampled. And, you know, due to some issues we had with the initial utility locate, the team had to return to collect representative baseline samples, as well as collect relevant media for some of our natural retardation and matrix diffusion studies. So I really want you to pay close attention here to transect A, starting from location 3 here. This is our what we're considering our online source, and then we're going to be following it all the way down to transect to A prime. So this is the ending point. We're going to be seeing a lot of figures in the subsequent slides that are going to be talking about this particular transect from the source all the way to the tree line here. This tree line is about, say, 900 feet from the source area, and but I just kind of want to give you guys the mental preparation before we move on. So I did mention previously that there was evidence for, let me move this arrow over here real quick, that there was evidence for vertical PFAS migration at NAS JAX. So this observation is questioned, and rightly so, because it has been our understanding that PFAS should sort of just stick around at the, you know, the air-water interface due to the, you know, polar aliphatic nature of the contaminant class. Looking at a cross-section of our transect A here, remember we have location 3 here. This is your the source area, moving down to about 900 feet, location 14, to the tree line, and we have wells that were screened to 50 feet below ground surface. As you can see, we have a pretty heterogeneous mixture of silty sand and clay layers coming about 10 feet, about 10 feet below ground surface, and another one about 35 feet below ground surface. And closer to the tree line here, we see another kind of clay layer emerging closer to 50 feet below ground surface. And this, on the silty sand and clay layer, low permeability zones start to become more and more apparent. It's almost like a solid chunk of clay and silt at our tree line here. But yeah, so we, as we move kind of closer to the left here, where our source area is, we notice that our low-K zones start to separate and pinch off, leaving only some silt and sand layers, which really do not allow much resistance in the presence of aquifer recharge. Again, keep in mind, this is Jacksonville, so there's plenty of recharge to go around. I feel like it rains there every day about noon, but I don't know. I'm kidding. Let's move on to the next slide here.
You're not kidding.
I am. I'm not kidding. I'm dead serious. So as evidenced by some of the work performed by USGS, it was really confirmed that this particular site does have high recharge. If you haven't stood outside in Jacksonville, yes, it does. In addition to this, there are a variety of conditions which contribute to sort of a radial groundwater flow near the source area here. Around here. And yeah, you can see in this plot over here. But moving on, continuing along the same vein on the next slide here, I guess to further understand factors affecting the hydrology of the site, both geologic borings and HBT were used, and the data generated from these investigations further confirmed that there is little resistance to downward flow resulting from high recharge. But what does this ultimately imply in regard to PFAS migration at the site? So on this slide here, I forgot that this was an animation. on this slide here, we have a small snippet kind of demonstrating vertical migration data from our first mobilization here for location three. On the right-hand side, we have data from our second mobilization, both of which kind of confirm these observations that we did see vertical PFAS transport phenomenon even all the way down to about 50 feet below ground surface in both our first mobilization and our second mobilization. Remember, data from this second mobilization utilized cluster wells. To kind of parse out that this was not a sampling artifact, whereas the first mobilization kind of, I think we just screened at multiple levels. But these are very interesting data, I guess, from the perspective of doing these high resolution and sampling, as well as kind of better understanding PFAS transport, because, you know, this is, I feel like we're learning new things every day with this contaminant class. So, you know, this last slide that I just presented gave some cursory insight as to PFOS and PFOA concentrations, but let's dive a little deeper into kind of the site-wide data, as well as provide differentiation between various PFAS classes. If we take a look at the two pie charts on the slide, we have a side-by-side comparison of the distribution of total PFAS concentration of the various classes in both soil and water. On the left-hand side, we have our total water concentrations. On the right-hand side, we have our kind of distribution of our soil concentrations. We have our figure legends down here. Dark blue legend represents total carboxylates. Lighter blue represents our fluorotelomers. The pink represents our ECF-derived or electrochemical fluorination-derived sulfonamides. And then this kind of small sliver here is our kind of ECF other derivatives. Keep in mind there's several thousands of different PFAS out there. So we just kind of lump them in as other. And then we have our sulfonates in the dark red, as we'll see here in both the soil and the the water distribution of concentrations here. So I just wanted to address a few key points here for this slide. If we take a look at the distribution of PFAS in the soil matrix here, we see that sulfonamides and sulfonates kind of compose the largest fraction, whereas carboxylates compose a smaller overall fraction of PFAS. And like I introduced in the section highlighting chemical properties affecting PFAS transport, we often times find increased sulfonate sorption onto organic fractions as opposed to carboxylates, which are generally more mobile. The sulfonamides are kind of an interesting group. You know, in the literature, I think there was an ESNT article from about 2013 or 2014 that mentioned sulfonamides, more specifically the N-ethyl and N-methyl sulfonamides. Think like N-methyl or N-ethyl FOSA. These can be D-methyl or de-ethylated to FOSA, which can further be transformed into PFOS. I can't quite remember the author of this paper, but the phenomenon is something which might be good to pay attention to, especially if you're doing site characterization and you have high sulfonamide hits. Sorry, I'm coming off of a cold this week, so I'm having to clear my throat more often than not. Okay, so, all right, so I got the 5-minute warning here. I'm going to be chucking through these slides here at a reasonable pace.
Not too fast.
So I guess to take a look at the some of the total PFAS at depth and at length, or starting from our source area, remember location three, moving on to the right, which is our further sampling point, we see that most of our PFAS, as you know, logic would tell you, is localized within our source area or locate zones in the soil here. But this is just a kind of a visual of where most of the contaminant mass is stored. We'll dive into this in a little deeper in the subsequent slides. And then we'll also differentiate between the various PFAS classes that are distributed throughout this entire map here. So just be prepared. Again, you know, to reiterate, the former fire training area at Jacksonville, point, our location three, is our, what we're going to consider our source area with our peak concentration. And then we're going to be moving on to within the transect day here to location 14. So imagine yourself looking at a 50-foot wall with all of this kind of cut out, and you're kind of standing over in this area looking at all the wells that are installed here at NAS Jacksonville along this transect. Excuse me. So this slide was what we saw, I guess, two slides ago. It just kind of highlights and reinforces what we're finding is that, you know, a lot of this contaminant mass is kind of bound up on our low permeability zones, providing some evidence for matrix diffusion into these clay layers. Ultimately, this is important, I guess, from the perspective of, you know, let's say if you do remediate a site, you do have to keep into consideration that you have these low-K zones that can be leaching, you know, stored PFAS over time. So just keep this in consideration that there is mass storage even at depth. Now looking at our the same transect, again, location here is our source. Moving on is our kind of tree line here where everything kind of pinches off into one uniform clay layer with a little bit of silt mixed into it. We kind of, you know, what kind of strikes us most here is that we are seeing kind of high PFAS hits all the way down to about 50 feet. You know, these data are pretty unique, I guess, from the perspective of typical PFAS localization, and that we would normally see kind of high concentrations localized close to the vadose zone. But, you know, in this case, with respect to kind of the regional recharge rate that I mentioned earlier, we are seeing kind of transport all the way down to about 50 feet below ground surface and kind of down horizontally towards our the last point of our transect day sampling point. Okay, so who's hungry for pie charts? Okay, I'm kidding. So this plot is similar to our transect plots that we showed earlier. Where's my arrow at? In which we have our different locations. So location three here, moving on to location 14, and then going down to from 0 to 50 feet below ground surface. You know, in this case, we are kind of just looking at a breakdown of individual PFAS classes at depth and distance. The blue marker kind of indicates carboxylates, light blue indicates fluorotelomers. Pink indicates our ECF-derived sulfonamides. Red indicates sulfonates. And then keep in mind that this these data are soil-specific data. I guess the few important items I wanted to address for this slide here is that sulfonates and sulfonamides typically tend to kind of stick around towards the surface. So you think your FOSAs, PFOS, they'll kind of just stay kind of localized closer to your source area. Our carboxylates in this case, or fluorotelomers, have a tendency to migrate a little more rapidly than our sulfonates and sulfonamides. more pie charts. So we see somewhat of a similar distribution profile in groundwater, in which our carboxylates and fluorotelomers migrate a little more rapidly, and our sulfonates and sulfonamides are kind of slower, retarded, or migrate to a lesser extent, except for what we observed here in our location 14, about 20 feet below ground surface sample. But we're still kind of trying to come up with an explanation for that, whether or not it's a transformation product or what. But so kind of some really cool, interesting data. How am I doing on time? Oh, start wrapping up. Okay. I'm going to go over one more data slide here, and then we'll wrap up. So one interesting piece of data we were able to take away from our high-resolution characterization was to kind of the ability to quantify both cationic and zwitterionic charges of PFAS localized in both soil and groundwater. you know, with these data and the slides that was kind of preceded this one here, we did find that through a high-resolution analysis performed at Oregon State and Colorado School of Mines that we were able to better understand kind of how molecular charge ultimately affects PFAS binding throughout our site. We were able to find that our cationic and zwitterionic PFAS species, which, you know, these are the total PFAS we're looking at here for both our source areas, they're pretty much sequestered at our source area with little to no downward migration or horizontal migration. So, yeah, like most of the contaminant mass is bound up as these positive or zwitterionic charged PFAS compounds. So I guess I'm going to start wrapping up here. I'm going to move over percent branching. This is kind of interesting data, too. But we'll get to the summary here. I guess in summary, compositional changes. We observed with depth and distance from the source, we saw ultimately increased carboxylate concentration with depth, especially in groundwater. The cations and zwitterions that I mentioned on the previous data slide that I actually presented on, these are typically sequestered in the source zone soil, but we do see some transport for groundwater, but it's very much more limited than the anionic species. Then we didn't get into this, but you know, there's differential transport that we observed for both our linear and branch PFOS and PFOA patterns. I guess to summarize some of the ongoing work that we're doing to kind of, we're doing kind of a few different sites here, but we're looking at destructive technologies such as senolysis, looking at improved sorbents, studying the retardation and matrix diffusion potential of PFAS in soils and groundwater, and as well as performing some research on on-site thermal treatment of PFAS in investigation-derived ways. Some other NESD projects that we're looking into is, again, exploring new commercially available sorbents, characterizing PFAS sources and source zones as kind of a more of a follow-on work to some other sites, and using these data to ultimately elucidate the fate and transport of PFAS. And we're also exploring some methods with some colleagues at University of Minnesota, plug them, Brown University and Jacobs to kind of stabilize PFAS in the subsurface. With that, I'm going to conclude my talk. Thank you for listening to me. Hopefully I can answer your questions.
Yes. We'll take just a couple of quick ones. Well, so early on in your talk, someone asked about where you're talking about when you kind of rank the higher PFAS sources typically. So would you differentiate between military versus municipal landfills when you're looking at landfill leachate, or are they similar?
I would say there would probably be a big differentiation. I mean, especially depending, because the municipal landfills will primarily be composed of commercial products. So as Lisa mentioned previously, and your food packaging, military landfill, you know, they might contain some biosolids, but there would ultimately be differentiation, I think, between the two sources. But I think that would be something worthy of exploring if you are trying to do some forensic work. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and also on that note, someone asked about how do manufacturing facilities rank? I'm sure it's higher for certain types of manufacturing.
Yes.
What are those that you see?
Yes, I'm not educated enough to speak on that in particular.
Okay, but yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Another participant asked about, let's see if I can get this, is the low volatility of PFOA and PFAS representative of all the polyfluorinated organic substances?
The per and poly? No, actually. You know, it's the volatility is not across the board. There's evidence that, you know, some PFAS does volatilize. And there's actually some technologies which are kind of using that physical characteristic to kind of drive some of these PFAS from source areas. You know, like I mentioned on our walk here about that thermal treatment. Some PFAS are more volatile than the others. But typically, we wouldn't expect PFAS to be, you know, volatile.
Right.
It pretty much stays at because of the solubility of it, you know.
Okay, but maybe more research required.
More research required to confirm that. So.
Okay, great. Okay, we are, as Jean mentioned in the chat, we're a little bit over on time right now, so I think we will go ahead and wind this one down. I want to thank Jovan again, and thank you, Lisa, for our presentations today. And just a quick reminder about the FRTR. So these talks today were re-presentations from an earlier FRTR meeting. We do have another one coming up in November. It'll be November 13th. We have a topic for this one. There's not an agenda available yet, but the topic is synthesizing evolving conceptual site models with applicable remediation technologies. So this will be held at the USGS headquarters in Reston, Virginia. We'll also be live streaming it if you'd like to join online, but this is open to the public. So we welcome you all to join either in person or online. And lastly, I want to remind you that this webinar and also the previous session one on PFAS are available or will be available online for a recording. So this one will be available in about a week. The one from back in June, that one is what you see on your screen here. That one is available now if you go to this website, or you can check the links from today's seminar homepage. Now I will hand it over to Jean Ballant to give you some instructions on how to stay connected with Cluin.
All right, thank you so very much, Cindy. I just wanted to walk through a few quick reminders before we go ahead and dismiss everyone from today's live broadcast. The first thing, if you're interested in staying in touch with us and hearing about these types of internet seminars and other online resources for cleaning up hazardous waste sites, I would strongly encourage you to visit us at cluin.org, the Cleanup Information Network, or sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, that goes out on the first of each month. If you're looking for copies of the presentation materials, we have those posted on the seminar links or resources page, and we'll be working to make sure that we get updated final versions from each of our speakers. You'll also find contact information for our presenters and other details for the session on the seminar homepage, including links over to the FRTR page if you're interested in signing up for that upcoming meeting. I would ask each of you to fill out a brief online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery. One of the most common requests I get as a moderator is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our sessions. While we do not issue those particular credit hours, we will give you a participation certificate that you can use along with your registration email or copies of the materials to document your participation with your own accrediting institution to try to get credit. So if you fill out the online feedback form, there is a box at the bottom of that form to check that you were here or to certify you participated in the whole thing. As long as you check that box, as soon as you send in your feedback form, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate with your information that you can then print out or download for your own records. Each person who has access to that link can fill out their own form. So if you happen to be a group sitting in a conference room attending together with one person's registration spot, as long as the person in the room shares that feedback link with you, you can each fill out the form and get your own participation certificate, even if you didn't register individually. And as noted at the top of today's session, we were recording our broadcast today. So for those of you who are unable to stay on for the full duration or are replaying the archived version, you can still follow these instructions to that online feedback form to give us your thoughts based off of the replay and get a participation certificate. You'll find links to the feedback form on the middle right under related URLs. I've also included it for quick reference in the Q&A window in the lower corner of your screen. And with that, I want to thank the over 360 individuals who joined us from across the country today for today's live broadcast. As soon as the recorded version is available for free replay, you'll get an email from me with instructions on how to access it. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks, so keep your eyes peeled for that. And with that, I'll echo Cindy's thanks to the organizers and presenters who helped put on today's session, and we'll go ahead and formally conclude.